So today I'd like to look at the fifth section from Shodoka, but first I'd like to start with some encouraging words. When the Buddha looked up at the Venus store, what did he realize, or what happened? This is a question somewhere in the middle of koan study that the student is asked. Of course, the teacher is neither looking for a medical response, he realized the underlying fact of oneness, for instance, nor even a Buddhist answer. He realized the truth of mutually dependent arising. The question demands a response from the starlit skies of your own belly. The teacher wants the experiential fact presented right in this moment. This can be done because the student has experienced exactly what the teacher has experienced, who experienced what her teacher experienced, and so on, back to and beyond Shakyamuni Buddha. This is why Wu Men, in his comment on the first koan from the Wu Men Kuan, wrote, "When you pass through this barrier, Mu, you will not only interview Zhao Zhou intimately, you will walk hand in hand with the ancestral teachers in the successive generations of our lineage. The hair of your eyebrows entangled with theirs, seeing with the same eyes, hearing with the same ears. Won't that be wonderful?" Wu Men is not speaking metaphysically here, nor metaphorically. He is pointing directly to a lived fact. He is pointing to and directly expressing reality. Shakyamuni Buddha's realization is beyond birth and death. It is before birth, so we call it unborn. And it goes out past anything called death, so we call it undying. This experience is the same for all Buddhas throughout space and time, and it is what Sesshin offers. In fact, it is what Sesshin demands. So, when he looked up at the Venus star, what happened? So today I'd like to look at the fifth section in Shodoka, the Song of Enlightenment, said to be written by Yong Cha in the early 8th century of our common era. The Foster Bros translation reads like this: "In one burst, superior people understand everything. The middling and inferior hear much but are sure of little. Just strip the filthy clothes from your own breast. Who could boast of progress? Yield to others' criticism, tolerate their denials. Trying to set fire to the heavens, they'll only tire themselves out. I hear them as though I were drinking ambrosia, dissolving, suddenly entering the inconceivable. If we see the merit of cruel words, they become the words of wise friends. When abuse and slander don't give rise to bitterness, doesn't that manifest the unborn power of compassion and perseverance? To penetrate the purport of the teaching is also to penetrate its expression. Samadhi and prajna are full and luminous, not stagnant and vacuous. So in one burst, superior people understand everything. The middling and inferior hear much, but are sure of little. This is a part of their translation which I don't particularly care for. And it has an echo in Sheng Yen's translation. He says, for the great ones, one breakthrough accomplishes all. For the middling and inferior, the more they hear, the less they believe. Sheng Yen comments on these lines in his Sword of Wisdom and writes about the different levels of karma from past lives and finds some explanation in why some students jump forward and some not. His writing is well-reasoned and reasonable, but as I look at it and think about it, I find myself going cold. I suppose when he's talking about karma, if he means mysterious affinity, this might open things up. It might create possibilities rather than narrow them into a system of good and bad, of fast and slow, of superior, mediocre, and inferior. Yamada Roshi was fond of saying, comparisons are odious, and this is a lovely point of practice. We are so quick to compare and judge. On more than one occasion, before writing to comment on the Shodoka blog, someone has written me and said, should I comment? The person who wrote before me, if I do indeed comment, wrote words that are so beautiful, or so poignant, or so smart. Can I compare to what is already there? These comparisons that we conjure from thin air are simply ways to excuse ourselves from fully participating. They are ways to excuse ourselves from being engaged with others, but just as importantly, they are excuses from being intimately engaged with ourselves. Pay attention in session. Watch how your mind may want to judge and compare. She is so steady, we say. Or he is so sloppy. She isn't doing that right. And on we go. And in these scenarios, the one thing that is a constant is that the comparer is always at the center. The one comparing is always the judge. And it is always with an arbitrary system that you are measuring not only the other person, but Sesshin. And also you are judging and comparing the unfolding of the universe, which is really, when you think of it, quite a feat to be able to do. Robert Creeley asked in an essay, what am I to myself that must be remembered and insisted upon so often? So what am I to myself that must be insisted upon so often? When we judge and compare, we concretize habituated patterns of thinking, feeling and experiencing. And as we do this, we are missing what is right before us, the vast and fathomless. We miss the liberation being offered in this very moment. When you catch yourself doing this, simply come back. Come back to Mu. Sit straight up. Open your hearts. Let your hands, though still in the round mudra, metaphorically be open, allowing whatever arises to arise. And then when it leaves, letting it leave. Not pushing away, not grabbing. Open, with full attention to each sound, to each breath, to each sensation. Whether you notice or not, if you continue to practice like this, your habit energy will loosen. Your associative thinking will find and create more space. And there will come, replacing your mind of judgment and comparisons, a joy. This joy will be very subtle at first, but if you return again and again to your open hands, to your warm heart, to Mu, doing Mu, that joy will grow. And at some point, you will notice that naturally, you are enjoying another person's quickness and your steadiness. You will notice you are enjoying another's intellect and your ability to empathize. You'll notice you're enjoying another's wisdom and your compassion, or the other's use of language and your straightforwardness. In this way, standards of superior, middling, and lowly become an opportunity to realize just this, and then just this, and then just this. It is when the tension of comparisons, it is when the tension of separation dissipates, that the Buddha can finally know herself as the Buddha. It is when that tension dissipates that you can know yourself just as you truly are. What a delight. What a relief. Just as you are. Nothing added, nothing needed to be subtracted. Simply you standing up, sitting down, eating, drinking. So the translation I read at the beginning of the talk goes like this. So in one burst, superior people understand everything. The middling and inferior hear much, but are sure of little. Here's another translation of these two lines. The best student goes directly to the ultimate. The others like to learn from those around them, but their faith is uncertain and unsteady. I find as I get older, and hopefully my practice deepens, that I am less sure who is superior or middling or lowly, and I seem unclear about best and good. It seems, and I don't know why, that some students keep their eye on waking up and practice with a slightly different intention and intensity. And some do have a natural proclivity for this thing we do. But the Lotus Sutra is emphatic that when the conditions are right, or the need strong, the earth will crack open for us, and legions of bodhisattvas and mahasattvas will come forth as grasses and trees, will come forth as boulders and stones and as swallows and bush tits, that the earth will crack open and come forth with moon and stars to aid us in seeing through our and the world's suffering. The sutra is emphatic about that fact, that we will see each thing as the radiant light of the Buddha, and in the same moment know our own light. However, if we keep chasing after outside things and learn a lot from others, our faith will be uncertain because we are depending on outside words, expressions, and events. The other day, a student said to a teacher that he would sure like to start practicing more. The teacher said, "We have formal practice 2 nights and 5 mornings a week. Why don't you come and join us?" The student said, "But you only give talks on one of those days." This is the pathway to uncertain faith in oneself, in others, and in the world. So what is faith? Faith is the openness you have, or faith is the openness you are, which brought you to this very moment. So you can depend and rely on that faith. Once a teacher asked a monk, "What is that sound outside the gate?" The student said, "The sound of wind and waves. That is chasing after things outside. Let go of any sense of direction. Let go of any sense of time or notions of knowing. And let the wind and waves come closer and closer and closer yet. Now, what is that sound? That is your faith." So Yungcha continues on saying, "Some may slander, some may abuse. They try to set fire to the heavens with a torch and end by merely tiring themselves out. I hear them as though I were drinking ambrosia. Immediately everything melts and I enter the place beyond thought and words." So I'd like to read you the footnote on ambrosia from the Foster Bros translation. It says, "Ambrosia translates the Chinese gan lu, which literally means sweet dew, but itself was a rendering of the Sanskrit term amrata, A-M-R-T-A, amrata, or undying. Amrata and ambrosia, which in Greek means not mortal or immortal, while cognate, each expresses the mythos of its particular culture. Ambrosia is the drink of the Greek immortals, while amrata, according to the Vedas, is a universal elixir showered on the earth every night to renew life. In Buddhist hands, the ladder also became a metaphor for the Dharma. So this is a wonderful footnote by Foster Ambrose, and I am thankful for their work. I wonder how many other allusions there are in our various readings with such powerful word images. The sense that the author, Yung Cha, is continually drinking the undying, the sweet dew of the Dharma, no matter what conditions he is living in, has a rather beautiful resonance with the first line, that the best student goes directly to the ultimate. The sweet dew is the source. It is the ultimate that we continually redirect towards. It is what we continually return to. Sweet dew, Amrata, is also an echo from the Lotus Sutra, which has a chapter on the Dharma rain that falls on all flowers, whether fragrant or not, whether lovely in color or not. This is the rain that falls on small trees and large, that falls on sweet grasses and weeds, and that falls on fertile soil or barren rock and sand. And it falls on you and me, superior or middling, or not even that. So have faith, and please continue to return, to turn towards again and again. We are, all of us, continually being wetted all the way through. We are, all of us, continually sipping this ambrosia, this sweet dew of unborn and undying. Yung Cha next writes, if we see the merit of cruel words, they become the words of wise friends. When abuse and slander don't give rise to bitterness, doesn't that manifest the unborn power of compassion and perseverance? It is easy to hear the echo of these words century later and to see a part in Tori Zenji's words when he says, all the more we can be especially understanding and affectionate with foolish people, particularly with those who become sworn enemies and persecute us with abusive language. That very abuse conveys the Buddha's boundless loving kindness. It is a compassionate device to liberate us from the mean-spirited delusions we have built up with our wrongful conduct from the beginningless past. With our open response to such abuse, we completely relinquish ourselves, and then the most profound and pure faith arises. By sitting in the middle of our lives with hands open and hearts warm, even when things are difficult and painful, we show or express the persistence and compassion of the unborn. When we don't grab at or push away, we can meet what comes towards us with much more clarity and confidence. Cruel or abusive words can unmoor us from our identity with a self which has been constructed by intellect and emotion, where it can unmoor us from the illusion that we need to protect something. With abusive or cruel words, the winds whip across the surface of the ocean, creating choppy waves, throwing spray and surf with wild abandon. But down deep, the water is steady and unmoving. This does not mean you won't take action at some point. However, you will not be reactive. The Diamond Sutra says, dwelling nowhere, bring forth that mind. This is, of course, our ideal, but it is also our practice here and now, not at some later date when we feel up to it. I'm going to just do a little bit more, though this is getting a bit long. Interestingly enough, in this particular section, Aiken uses the word scandal. He says, I hear their scandal as though I were drinking ambrosia. Immediately everything melts. And a couple lines later he says, when I consider the virtue of abusive words, I find the scandal monger is my good teacher. So Madeline noted on our Shodoka blog that scandal has its roots in the Greek skandalon, S-K-A-N-D-A-L-O-N, meaning a trap or a snare or a stumbling block. So though I don't wish criticism or cruel words on anyone, these words and actions of cruelty or meanness can snare us. They trap us. And if we ignore them or fight against them, the snare only tightens. But if we receive them with open hands, they may trip us. They may trip us out of whatever sense of self we may be holding on to, no matter how subtle and nuanced. These abusive words throw us down into the mud and dirt, and there we find a ground of practice we may not have touched before. And it is with this new grounding, the grounding of waves and wind, of swallows and gulls. It is with this grounding of breath, posture, and community where we can be held and sharpened until we have the ability to come forward and act. And for Zen students, all Zen students, superior, middling, or lowly, acting is our duty, our responsibility, our gift. It is the ground of Buddha Dharma, for to be mature in Zen is to be mature in expression. Okay, thank you.